Welcome to the Cutting the Gordian Knot podcast. Today we are joined by Catholic priest, co-founder of the Acton Institute, author, free market advocate, Father Sirico. It's a rare day that I ask for biographical information from a guest, but your story is just too good to pass up. So if you could fill us in a little bit about who you are, how you ended up advocating for Catholic principles and free market principles at the same time. We'd love to hear it. And thanks for coming on to the show.
It kind of is the oddest conversion since St. Augustine, as far as I can tell. So I will give you the short version of it. And that is that I was raised in a nominally Catholic home, very strong culturally Catholic home in New York. I'm an Italian American. And so our family was very much, you know, I had all the catechesis as a child, the training as a child. But in my teens, I wandered from the church. And in my early 20s, found myself, by this time I was living on the West Coast, involved in the passions of the left, you know, the new left movement out there. I knew Jane Fonda and Tom Hayden. I worked on their campaign it was called the Campaign for Economic Democracy at the time. And a lot of the other, what were then nascent progressive movements, the feminist movement, the gay movement, the tail end of the anti-war movement. So we're going back to the early 70s here. And it was during that period of time that a friend introduced me to his friend, and this friend had a very different political and economic point of view. I had, by this time, abandoned the practice of the Catholic faith, and we struck up a series of conversations. And I always like a good argument with a bright person. He was that. And he just really gave me pause. I had a lot of things to think about what he was telling me and the books he was recommending that I read, which I read. And the long and the short of it was that I had first a kind of economic political conversion. And then some time after that, probably a few years after that, rediscovered my Catholic faith. I kind of saw the grounding of the philosophy and the economics, the kind of metaphysical, philosophical grounding of all of that, because the books I was reading at the time were written largely by secular economists, Milton Friedman and Friedrich Hayek and Mises and Rand. And I was looking for something deeper than just that. Those were good utilitarian solutions. But I kind of bumped back into my Catholic faith. By this time, I'm in my mid-20s. And really began to, you know, really become an intelligent Catholic. And then went to seminary. And in seminary, found the same stuff that I had left on the streets of Los Angeles back in the 70s, that is to say left-wing theology in the form of what at that time was called liberation theology. And during my time in seminary, studied it, really grappled with it, had lots of arguments with seminary brothers and professors and superiors and all that. And once I was ordained, I had this idea to found an institute that would address these questions. And that's what I did in 1990.
That's incredible. You know, it's kind of a similar way that I came into the Catholic faith. I was raised Protestant and never really had any philosophical grounding of anything, never heard a compelling argument for God. And as a high schooler, I was given by a friend a book, The God Delusion by Richard Dawkins.
Oh, yes.
And it shook my faith, but it actually got me very interested in biology and in biological evolution. And as I looked into that, I realized I actually didn't care about plants and animals. I cared about the way that this extraordinarily complex system is transferring energy and materials to create these complex, incredible structures and creatures. And that brought me into economics. And in economics, trying to get to the root of that brings you into philosophical and even theological questions. And then studying that actually gave me the grounding for my faith that I needed studying philosophy and allowed me to enter the Catholic Church not that long after. So it's an avenue into the church that's underappreciated.
It's a similar journey you had. You know, the reason for that probably is that economics as a intellectual discipline, a scientific discipline, if you will, really comes out of theology. A lot of people don't realize that. It comes out of the school of Salamanca in the 16th century, meditating on moral obligation, having to do with the use of material resources. And they developed a whole kind of systematic way of thinking about use of material resources and scarcity and supply and demand and inflation, all of those things. And so really the scholastics are the founders of economics.
Yeah. So from the beginning, there is that deep connection between, well, Catholic thought and modern economics. We actually have a question that came in from the some students over at the Catholic University of America. They want to know what the most basic or fundamental principle is in Catholic social teaching. And I'll add, what do you think the most basic and fundamental thing we need to know about the markets are, and how is it that they're brought together inside of the church?
Well, I mean, the answer to the question is the fundamental, indispensable foundation of Catholic social teaching is the dignity of the human person, understanding who human beings are, a right understanding of anthropology. The Second Vatican Council described it something along the lines of Christology is anthropology and anthropology is Christology. So you start there with the human person. Of course, John Paul II did a magnificent job of unfolding the reality of this. And even though economics in the popular mindset has to do with abstractions and equations, in point of fact, the name of the great text of Ludwig von Mises was Human Action. So his approach was exactly the human person. What do human beings need? Now, he comes at it from a different horizon, or approaches it from a different horizon. But nonetheless, I think that's the connecting point, and a lot needs to be filled in there. But that's the connecting point to my mind.
Gotcha. You know, you could get most Catholics who've studied theology and philosophy to give you at least a basic rundown of what the natural law might look like and how things are oriented towards an end. You know, if you frustrate that end, that's a problem. You stop the tree from giving leaf. Okay, well, that's a type of natural evil. But as soon as you bring it into, well, what's the nature of man? Just like the tree puts out leaves, but it also puts down roots. We reach up for God, but we also reach out to each other. We reach out to the things of the earth to transform and create them. We have natural actions, which express themselves in markets. I mean, birds build nests, we build houses, and that's an economic activity.
Right.
So what do you see as the role of like natural law stuff in that connection into the free market? Do you think it's strictly theological that we have to push our view from a theological perspective, or do you think that there's things in the philosophical or natural law tradition that we can bring to bear too?
I think what you said so succinctly is exactly the reality, that the is of our being implies the ought. Now, the one corrector I would offer you, and this gets us into the kind of transition from the natural law into theology, is that it is true that people build houses and birds build nests. But the difference with human beings is that we build hotel chains. And what's the difference here? It reflects the human relationship to the material world has to do with more than utility and has to do with more than instinct. it has to do with reason. And that amplifies. It's the human capacity not only to reflect upon our existence, but to reflect upon that reflection. And that enables us to take what is natural to us and common to animals, the instinct, the being bound to the material world, as animals are, as humans are, but to distinguish our bonding with the material world from animals, in that animals are bound to things by instinct and human beings are bound to things by reason. And it's that reason that implies transcendence. It goes beyond just the shelter and it becomes the service to others and the profitability of it. That is, what do we do with scarcity? God, the image in Genesis is that God places man and woman in a garden, not a jungle. And the difference is, of course, that the garden needs to be worked. And the whole image of God in the first page of the Bible is the impresario, right? The one who is bringing things into being. And then God says to man and woman that you are made in my image and likeness. So this is the connection. So I don't think you need to begin. And I think it's really an argument from authority if a believer just begins talking to a non-believer and points to scriptures and thou shalt not steal and all the rest of it. I think it's ineffectual.
So as far as our Catholic listeners here, let's dig into that a little bit more. You mentioned, of course, we're animals, but we're rational animals, as Aristotle might say, and Aquinas right. would follow. So is that the reason for which we have dominion over the earth? Is that connected with the ability to, like what you say, to create the proverbial hotel chain versus just the house? And, Rerum Novarum teaches how, yeah, God created and he imprints principally on us and other rational creatures like the angels, his image. But there's also images and there's a type of revelation or an icon of God in all the things he made. And Rerum Novarum suggests that when we work and we have good human labor, we leave an imprint of ourselves on that labor. So I'd like you to comment, if you can, about how the fact of our being rational allows us to imprint on things, in a sense, our image, kind of like God did to us. I mean, how exactly does that function, and why is that important?
Well, it's important because what it tells us is that there's something more than the use of the thing that we are, if I may use the phrase, manipulating. And I want to use that phrase in a very precise understanding. Manipulation is the working with one's hands. Right. So it's not exploitation ipso facto. It is this human being that is utilizing the material world. So what comes together is both our physicality and our rationality and our transcendence. And that's what imposes a kind of moral understanding, a moral ordering upon our world, so that it's the human being who treats nature, but treats nature not just with a sense of dominance, but also with a sense of service, because the human being is aware that he's in relation to something more than the material, that there's transcendence, that we can conceive of things that go beyond the physiological reality.
Yeah, that's quite the point that you're let, you know, I don't think most people would think that at this point in the discussion, we're linking, we would be linking economics and we'd be linking work with actually understanding the transcendence, which God offers to us as rational beings to enjoy and participate in. But I do think that that's what work does. That's why it was offered in the Garden of Eden. But I think work gets a bad rap right now. It's often viewed just as toil. It's viewed as if the incarnation never happened. So what would you say to people who do see work just as drudgery and say, all right, this sounds like some highfalutin stuff that somehow we can we can arrive at some type of transcendence because we're rational creatures and we're working, like God worked for so many days and then he rested. But like, what does that mean to, I hate to be practical, but if we're to be practical for a moment, what do you say to somebody whose job is a drudgery and needs some tools, needs a, some type of lens to see the transcendence of even their work?
Well, I think it is precisely in apprehending the significance of what their work is. Now, if work is drudgery, if work is, by the way, let me just back up for a moment and make a distinction. The vocation to work is what they call in theology prelapsarian. It comes before the fall. The toil nature of work happens after the fall, so that the whole of the created order is distorted by sin. And not just work, but childbearing too, right? Remember what God says to Eve, that she's will now have pain in this labor. Interesting that the word labor is used in that context too. So I think we need to understand this distinction between the fact that God calls man and woman to tend the garden, which for some people could be considered drudgery, right? Tending a garden might be drudgery, but there was something that they could perceive in their work that transcended their work because they were doing it. And then after the fall, it becomes this drudgery or this work by the toil of your brow, that kind of thing. Toiling. Now, if you're asking a kind of pastoral advice to someone who finds himself in a job that he doesn't like, I would say, well, you use your rationality, assess the situation. And by assessing, I don't mean just make an economic analysis of it. I mean, that's part of it, but that's not the whole of it, because a person could end up deciding, I am going to take a lesser paying job because this alternative work that I would do gives me a greater sense of who I am. I mean, any number of people do that. Religious priests and nuns do that all the time. I could have made a lot more money in my life if I hadn't gone into the priesthood. And I think that everyone can do that in some sense. So,
gotcha. So it kind of shifting gears here. We may have jumped ahead a little bit from where we probably should have started. Let's kind of go back a bit to what are some misconceptions that you think the average Catholic has about Catholic social teaching? I think both of us are very much in favor of markets. We believe that work and human creativity links us into our prelapsarian vocation. It allows us to image God, as we've been talking about. But I think there's some misconceptions about Catholic social teaching and its connection to the market. What do you think are the most popular?
I think the most popular misconceptions, and this dates from the aftermath of Rerum Novarum, particularly in the United States, but elsewhere as well internationally. And that was to see in Rerum Novarum what theologian and advisor to the bishops, John A. Ryan, called semi-socialism. It confuses the call to share and to qualify one's relationship to the material world with a form of economic coercion, which we know as socialism. Socialism is a confusion on that end too. People think of socialism as merely sharing of implementing justice. So a lot of the Catholic rhetoric today about the church's social teaching uses the term social justice in a way that means justice achieved by some form of socialism. And I think if I were to point to one one misconception that leads to a lot of other misconceptions, it would be that. I was recently interviewed when I was in Spain, this book that I wrote on the parables we may have occasion to talk about came out in Spanish, and there was a Catholic, I don't know if I would call it left-wing journalist, but maybe more Catholic distributist, more favorable, more standard kind of what we're talking about here, the kind of social justice. Mm-hmm. And as we were talking, she was quoting various passages, she was a very knowledgeable woman, various passages in Rerum Novarum. And I just in passing made reference to the fact that private property was sacred. And she stopped me and she said, that's almost an offensive term. I said, is it really? I said, do you know where I got it from? Exactly. She just, it just was obliterated from her calculation. So
that's been exactly my experience with other Catholics who have read Rerum Novarum. So I did a 6-part series on Rerum Novarum where I did a line by line commentary on the entire document and
created great. A podcast
series. Yeah. And I had never read it before I did that. And honestly, I was a little bit wary about what I was going to find, because that's typically what you hear. Oh, Rerum Novarum and Catholic social teaching, it's in favor of government redistribution and fair wages and minimum wages. Heck, let's throw that in. And boy, I was so pleasantly surprised. It sounded like it was written by Rush Limbaugh. it really does come down firmly on the side of markets, private property. It does explicitly condemn socialism. I think it's a tremendous document.
It is. You know that Leo the 13th, whose Italian name slips me now, it just slipped me. But when he was a cardinal, he praised, that was about the time that Bastiat was writing, Friedrich Bastiat, who was the great French classical liberal, who praised Bastiat's writings and his work. This was before he became Leo the 13th.
Wow.
So I think that's in the back of his mind, you know.
So how do we, one of the things which pops up in that document is the concept of, I think they call it a fair wage or a living wage or whatever the verbiage is in particular. How do you understand that?
Well, I understand it the way scholastics understand it. It is a living wage. And I mean, who would know what I can live on better than me? And I think that that reality, especially combined with the principle of subsidiarity, which is implied in Rerum Novarum, it tells us something about the kind of structure that is necessary. Now, there is something that goes beyond the market, that human beings are owed something than just what they can get by their ability in a market. But that is not the first or prime function of the government to achieve that. And that's where the principle of subsidiarity becomes so important, that we have to discern these things at the most local level before we jump it up to higher levels of political or bureaucratic arrangement. And I think that's what you're seeing in Rerum Novarum. I think that John A. Ryan really ended up distorting the tradition in that regard.
Oh, I'm not familiar with him. So what exactly did, how exactly did he distort it?
Well, he rereads Rerum Novarum and he uses the term semi-socialist.
Oh.
The whole apparatus that we've heard, you know, especially in the 80s when the bishops were talking about the economy and stuff, the whole social justice apparatus and presumption in the American context comes out of John A. Ryan. He was called the Right Reverend New Dealer.
Gotcha. You know, it's been a long time since I've read The Wealth of Nations, but when I got to that part of Rerum Novarum where it's talking about living wage, it reminded me of a section where Adam Smith is talking about how if anybody would paid workers less than what they could actually live on, they would die.
They wouldn't have the workers.
And then they would lose the workers, supply would contract, at which point, you know, the price would then rise, of course, when you shift the supply line. And further, if you don't give them enough to raise children, well, then, well, you're just pushing this down the line one generation, and then labor will contract in your next generation, and now you're paying higher wages. So he says it's just best to pay people the amount that they need to live and raise a child. But I like that he takes this in a way which Rerum Novarum and the tradition certainly don't. It sounds a little brutal and utilitarian, but interestingly, it arrives at something which is the same. Yeah, you could pay people living wages for economic and moral reasons.
I think what this kind of politicized approach to the economy fails to take into consideration is the intelligence and the knowledge that human beings themselves have about what they need to live. And it places that decision making in the hands of politicians and bureaucrats. I remember I was in New Zealand many years ago, and I had given a lecture, and this woman got up and objected. Well, she didn't object. She was really very sarcastic. She said, "Well, how did your? I'm just a woman," she said. "I wouldn't know. You're a man, so you have to tell me." So she's being very sarcastic. How does this economy that you're describing account for my work in the home? Well, that's a good and fair question. I said, but you know, one presumes that when your husband is negotiating a business deal, he has that concern in mind. Presuming you're not working, you're just working in the home, that he brings that to the negotiating table, as does every other competitor in that employment search. And that's calculated by the supply and demand of workers and employers. So, we just eliminate that whole source of knowledge. We think that people don't know. They have to have somebody tell them what they can live on. And that's where you get this distorted thing where people really now can't live on the salaries they get, because the market has been so distorted and so dumbed down by the political interests that weigh on politicians in order to get votes.
I've often compared to, I think 100% agree with what you're saying, and we definitely got to follow that second thread, because I want to hear what you see is specifically distorted and how we could live better. But on the topic of that lady who brings up the objection, I often think I give a comparison which is biological to active and passive transport systems in living things, and that there's certain scales, like at the cell, where there's not really any active transport, or not really much. It's just, if there needs to be resources over in one part of the cell, well, it just happily floats over based on the diffusion. It's just the concentration gradient allows it to diffuse from one side to another, and even between cells, right? But once you hit a certain scale, it requires that you have active transport, like a circulatory system, for example. And I think of that with the economy too, that people often say, well, hang on, where's the economic, where's the price system? Where's this going on with me and my family, like a wife and her husband? And the answer is, no, you misunderstand. That's too small of a scale. That's unneeded. You just need diffusion inside of a home, inside of a family, heck, inside of the church and Acts. It wasn't at a scale which required an active transport system. It simply was, if there was need over here, then it moved over, absent prices, because the information that was needed didn't need to be carried by prices. It could be contained in person, something impossible at scale.
But so, even in religious communities, I've seen this happen.
Where you
get a large enough community and people, it gets distorted itself. But, you know, they don't have that knowledge.
And kind of segueing into the second part that you brought up there. So it works at a small scale, and then you need active transport, you need price systems, you need markets at a larger scale. You mentioned a few distortions which come from lack of subsidiarity and like kind of a Hayekian knowledge problem, which are plaguing the economy now and making it difficult for people to provide for their families. So it's kind of an inversion of that. So what specifically do you see that's been messed up that's harming people, you know, maybe closer to the poverty line that could be fixed?
Well, oh, let me choose.
You have 10 hours to say it. No.
Yeah, right.
There's a long list, right?
Yeah, no. Well, I mean, first of all, you know, it's the false, the demand that prices be lowered, for example. There's a great, one of my favorite books of literature is Italian. He's kind of, I would call him the Italian Dickens, so to speak. If the Italian Shakespeare was Dante, the Italian Dickens was Manzoni. And he wrote a book called, in English, it's translated The Betrothed. And in the middle of this book, there is a strike that goes on in Milan, a bread strike. And, you know, it's terrible. The politicians are getting involved and they decide what they're going to do is they're going to impose a price, a lower price on the production of bread. And so they do that. And Manzoni has this kind of observation. The narrator has an observation. It said that the officials thought that they it could be likened the officials' decision to lower the price of bread could be likened to a woman of a certain age who thinks that she can become younger by changing the date on her birth certificate. You know, it's just an ignoring of reality. It's an illusion that people have. And of course, politicians are particularly incentivized to do this. It doesn't recognize the reality of the information that comes from prices. Mm. All the information that comes from what you pay for a good is embedded in that. And to distort that, to obfuscate that in one way or another, is to have the experience of the socialist oversupply or undersupply of goods and services.
You know, we just did an episode last week, which was comparing book one of Plato's Laws to a section in Zechariah and a section in Revelation. And there's a point where the angel comes out and there's all the four horses of death that get released. And one of them is economics. And the angel says, 2 pounds of wheat for a day's wages, you know, 6 pounds of barley for a day's wages, which are incredibly high prices. And I could imagine these people at the time simply saying, oh, no, angel, just say something different and it will all be fine.
Or, you right, know, right.
Just announce a different set of prices, guys.
Yeah.
For everybody. And there goes the famine.
Yes.
It's quite silly to imagine that simply by announcing a new price, you could affect the relative scarcity of the thing which is being priced.
Exactly. And it's done repeatedly.
Absolutely. You know, and one that it doesn't, you know, so Thomas Sowell has an interesting perspective on wages. And I was reading one of his books recently, and I like the way he put it. He said, so often when we look at wages, we think only nominally. And we ask the question, why don't they just get paid more money, instead of asking the real question, which acknowledges that there's a trade, there's a mutually beneficial trade going on. Why don't we ask the value? Why don't we ask the question, why is it that people can't generate more value to be traded per hour such that they could live a better life? We'd never ask that question. We always say, why don't we pay them more in nominal wages, instead of asking, why is it that their nominal wages, which ought to overall reflect the quantity of value they're producing in their labor, why can't we up the value part? You know, we often think in this nominalist haze.
I have worked over the years with a lot of seminarians of different denominations, and I always ask them an economic question. You know, for instance, who determines the wages or the price of a good or service. And they all think that the owner of the business does, and are really shocked to find out that it's really the consumer who determines what the price is. Because I said, you think a price is the sticker on the tag on the item, but the real price is what is exchanged for it. Mm-hmm. It's not what's asked for it. It's what exchanged for it. And to go back to what we were talking about, if you distort that awareness, you just put everything in disarray.
You know, Rerum Novarum has a wonderful section where it says, almost in passing, and I wish people could take this as just so given they would say it in passing, that a worker cannot be paid more than he produces in value. So this creates an upper limit to the wages that can be paid. And it's kind of, that almost sounds tricky if you think only in terms of dollars, but you know, I've in other episodes said it in the form of potatoes. If you have a potato-based potato farming economy, if everybody only hoes out 10 potatoes a day, it is impossible to pay them all 11. But somehow we miss this fact that the amount that you're creating in value does actually set an upper limit to what you can be paid in wages, lest the firm be drained of all its proverbial potatoes and goes bust.
Yes. Yeah. We think we can invent reality. Mm-hmm. It's very stubborn, isn't it? Reality is very stubborn.
So what other misconceptions do you think Catholics have? What's something that you would want particularly Catholic listeners to know? A lot of them really do have the right intention.
Really do want
what's best for others. But as I've reminded them about 1,000 times, the compassion of the ignorant is cruelty. That's an unbreakable equation, it seems, in reality, that if you pair your compassion with ignorance, you're going to hurt people. So they're compassionate. They got some of it.
Yeah. No, I think one of the things that people, maybe this is an aesthetic thing, but a lot of people, Catholics and non-Catholics, good people, as you say, that somehow profits are by their nature exploitative. Mm. That somehow that if I'm making a large profit on a thing, in a free economy, of course, you know, because you can make a large profit by mugging somebody, you know, in a back alley. But if it's in an exchange, that, and I walk out of there with, I profit on the thing, that somehow I've done something wrong. I've injured someone, I've stolen something, and they kind of conflate the profit and what the person who has earned the profit does with the profit. Those are two different moral categories. In a free exchange, I can only make a profit by serving the need of the other person, who determines that what they exchange with me is worth what they're offering me. And I do the same thing. So it's a voluntary exchange. We both come away, you know, win-win situation. Now, the moral question then becomes, I walk away from this exchange with multiples of what I had before. What do I do with that? Now, I can do any number of things with that. I can support my family. I can save it. I can reinvest it. I can squander it. I can buy baubles with it. I can worship it, you know, in the way that some people do with labels and that kind of thing. I think that's a confusion in the mind of many good people, the distinction between making a profit and then utilizing the profit in a correct way.
Perfect. There's a lot of people right now who are really denigrating the idea of being rich as such. But like what you said, there's many different ways to use, many different ways to actually hold and retain wealth. So what are morally problematic ways? What can you sketch out a few ways that one could be a billionaire, for example, while being entirely in line with Catholic teaching?
Well, I think there's a lot that could be said about that. I've led retreats with business people on things like that, on these themes. I think to be most fundamental, most foundational, it's the way you think about the wealth that you have. If you think about it as essentially validating yourself, validating your dignity, getting it over on someone else, if you ship what you have, if material object is more important to you than people, if you're going to choose the profit, a very common way in which people fall into this is when they choose a profit over their family. That is, choose to work at the expense of being with their kids. Those would be ways in which people have great resources. A man came to me once, a very wealthy man, and he was really discovering his faith. And he said, can you recommend, it may have been in Lent that he asked me this, can you recommend what I can do to really be deeper grounded spiritually? And I said, well, you know, you spend your whole week in the market doing things. And I said, what if you went just down to the soup kitchen and volunteered to work in the soup kitchen for a few hours a week? He said, Father, do you have any idea of how much money I would be leaving on the table by working in a soup kitchen? If I worked 4 hours in a soup kitchen, I could buy that soup kitchen. And I said, I see the confusion here. You thought I was suggesting you go down to the soup kitchen to help the people who needed the food. I was suggesting that you do it for yourself, for your own spiritual. That this is a resource. The poor are a resource to us spiritually, that we come in touch with Christ in, to use Mother Teresa's phrase, the distressing disguise of the poor. And that's a way in which I think people misconceive. Everything can't be calculated on the market. I think we need to have the calculation of a market in the ways that we've already talked about, but that doesn't mean everything can be. You can't count the cost with your kids. You have to waste your time with your kids, so to speak, which of course is not a waste of time.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a good point that I think a lot of people, particularly distributists, seem to get this extra confused.
Yeah.
The boundary between family and market. And you hear them say things like, you know, the market doesn't deliver us morality. It's like, okay, but the church doesn't make us shoes. All right. You know, exactly. they have very different purposes here. You know, I don't think that's a way to condemn. You have to understand what this institution is to understand what it's for.
Right.
And then see if it's delivering. And yeah, I mean, not all of life is about the market, of course. And there's certain times where we trade the possibility to make great fortunes and great fortunes, even in 4 hours, for the opportunity to pursue the corporal acts of mercy, for example.
That's right.
And that's a darn good trait. Who would trade? What is it? What am I looking for? Trade all this. What can you trade for your soul? Right.
Yes. What will you give up for your soul? Yeah. You know where I think the philosophical root of this is, as we find confusions in theology and morality so often, in Gnosticism. Gnosticism is the idea that there is a radical split in reality between the material and the spiritual, and that the material is evil and the spiritual is good. And you see this great struggle going on even in the pages of the New Testament over these contending church. In fact, the first canon of the New Testament was compiled by a Gnostic whose name was Martian. And he wanted to say, you know, his canon, by the way, eliminates all of the Jewishness of Jesus.
Hmm.
Why? Because of the creation, that God made the heavens and the earth and said it was good. The physical world, he said it was good. And he wanted to kind of spiritualize Jesus. And I think this bleeds itself out in a thousand different ways, but sacramentally, morally, but in this economic understanding, by thinking that the only real important thing is to just shun the world and all of the material things in the world, and just contemplate God in himself as though we could enjoy the beatific vision here on earth. We don't.
Yeah, so it makes that move where it shuns good material things.
Yeah.
As if there was some type of dualistic nature.
Exactly.
You know, another thing it does is, I think I'm thinking of Simon the Magician, who, I mean,
he was, could buy it.
Right. Yeah, he makes another mistake, right, which is he thinks he can buy the Holy Spirit. So yeah, it's this denigration of the material. It's the seeking to purchase things. It's the sin of simony, this seeking to purchase things which are not for sale. What it is it's a terrible, ridiculous confusion in the role of both markets and church.
Yes. Or the physical and the spiritual, the transcendent and the corporeal. I mean, and the incarnation comes to give the lie to that whole thing. You know, God redeems us not from outside of the world, but from within it, through the womb of a woman. You know, he is one of us in all things but sin. It's most frustrating, and it's a devious heresy because it's resilient because it can come up in a lot of different and manifest itself in a lot of different ways. I'll give you an example. I think it's Gnosticism that's at the root of the two economic errors, religious errors of our era. That is liberation theology, which seeks to canonize the poor and demonize the rich, and the prosperity gospel, which seeks to canonize the rich and demonize the poor. And they're both rooted to a misunderstanding of how the material economic world relates to our relationship with God, to our spirituality.
Father Sirico for Pope right here. So there's a section, I think it's Leviticus 17, is one of my favorite verses. It says, do not preference the poor because they are poor, or the rich because they are rich.
Exactly.
Do not pervert justice, but judge your neighbor fairly. And I always remind my listeners, don't be a justice pervert. And while you're at it, just don't be any type of pervert.
Right.
But it is, it's a perversion of justice when we do either of those that you mentioned, yeah, either putting the poor on a pedestal as if everything was for the sake of the poor, kind of going with Judas on the idea that we should just stop honoring Christ through the church and just give everything to the poor, right? As if they were to be in the place of Christ and not a means by which we can care for Christ through his church. And then there's the other way that prosperity gospel, where we completely misread the blessings which are offered throughout scripture, the real blessings.
Yes.
And we take these as just an exaltation of self. Both of those are disastrous. Right. And both of those miss the real Jesus.
Exactly.
You know, I was just kind of thinking as you were bringing some stuff up is, you know, we kind of kicked this off talking a little bit about how labor actually can connect us with God, how it can bring us into that transcendence, how that can help us to image the work that God himself does. And you talked about how the incarnation just now is something which blows up a lot of these Gnostic nonsense, if you will. And I was thinking about how 30 of Christ's years were spent in secret engaging in the market as a carpenter.
Yeah.
And that became part of his identity. We see that in the Gospels, where people say, aren't you like the carpenter's son? Right. That becomes part of who our Savior is. So when he does his work of ultimate worship on our behalf, it's impressed with that identity as the carpenter. So I think in a sense, it shouldn't come as any surprise that he carries a giant beam of wood on his back, like he probably did for his dad Joseph 1,000 times.
Right.
He had nails go through his palms. That's something he's deeply acquainted with. Wasn't the first time there was a nail in his hand.
Yeah.
His human work which could have been difficult and drudgery. I know, you know, I build houses depending on the day. I'm a carpenter. I understand. That itself turns out was a means by which he could show the perfect worship to our Creator.
And you see it too in the sacraments, you know, which all of which have this physicality associated with them. Baptism is water. Marriage is the conjugal union. The sex act is the sacrament, the matter of the sacrament of matrimony. And I'm intrigued by the Eucharist itself, because it's not grapes and grain, right? It's bread and wine. And what's that? It's the work of human hands. It's been transformed by human beings. And then this is offered to God, who exchanges in the Latin, it's called the scambio. Maybe that's the Italian version. The exchange that takes place. We give to God what we have made, and he gives to us what we could not make. And so all of the sacraments are grounded in a physicality, in a, you know, human material reality.
Well, that's an awesome point. We even call it the sacramental economy, right?
Yes.
We both bring this type of work. We both bring this offering. And in this exchange, we get an incredible amount of profit on one side and consumer surplus on the other.
Exactly.
To use the economic jargon. Well, I know we're running to the end of the hour. I could talk to you for the next 10 days easily. But I did want you to tell us a little bit about a few insights from your recent book, The Economics of Parables. As soon as we're off this, I got to order that book because I can't wait to read it. That sounds wonderful. So give us a few insights of that, and then we'll have to start.
Well, let me underscore the preamble to it, because it is not what I'm not saying in this book is that in telling the parables that Jesus is teaching us economics. That's not at all my point in the book. I don't want to eisegete the scriptures. I want to exegete them. My point is that economics is so natural a part of human existence that even before the systematic way of understanding the economy comes into being through the scholastics and later Adam Smith, even before that, there was an economic reality by virtue of the fact that we're placed in the world of scarcity and that we have to make good use of scarce resources for the things that we need in life. So the whole backdrop of human life on Earth has this economic dimension because we live in the context of scarcity. And then what I do is I take 13 parables, and they're not, I could have done others, maybe should have done others, but these were the ones that I did, and just draw out the economic presuppositions that exist in them. So, for instance, you have the pearl of great price. It's interesting that pearls in the ancient world were not manufactured the way they are today, very often. They were found in nature. And that this man, the shortest parable, this man comes upon this pearl in a market. There's somebody trading it. And he, like any good entrepreneur, recognizes the value of this pearl. He knows, he has a discerning eye, whatever prepared him to be able to identify this pearl of great price. And it's so important to him that he relinquishes all that he has in exchange for that. The other interesting part of that is that, remember, that in the parables, we hear this phrase very often used in the parables. Jesus says the kingdom of God may be likened unto. So we remember that the parables are pointing us beyond the physical world. And this man, in this parable, the thing that the kingdom of God is being likened unto is a luxury good. It has no utility. It has no function other than this ornamental beauty to it. And so I think those elements go into that. And of course, it points us to something higher. And I try and do that in each of these parables that I look at, the 13 of them, to say, now, what is the higher thing? The higher thing, of course, is the kingdom of God. Is, you know, you see this in the relationship of the prodigal son and the loving father and the other son, who is a very important part to this whole story. These two sons are looking at their father as their resource for what makes their life worth something. In the case of the prodigal, he takes his inheritance and goes and dissipates it. In the case of the one who stays home, he's complaining because he didn't have, a goat to share with his buddies. And the father is at the center of the story, trying to draw these sons into union with him in the banquet, you know, at the end. It's a very interesting story about contracts and inheritance and, you know, how you view your father, your benefactor. Of course, there's the wonderful story of the man who goes out to hire laborers during the day. And he begins by hiring laborers with a specific contract. If you come and work for me, I'll give you the usual daily wage. And then he goes, and the offer becomes vaguer, more vague as the day goes on. And at the end of the day, when he goes to pay them, the first become last and the last become first, so that the ones who were last hired were paid the same wage, and the ones who were first hired are paid the same wage, and they become envious. It really is. I mean, again, I'm not saying that this is what Jesus is saying, but it's really a whole Marxian view. They had this Marxian view that I worked for this, and I, you know, this is what you owe me, rather than the subjective reality of the contract. You were happy at the beginning of the day. Nothing has changed objectively. It's only your subjective perception. And so he says to them very explicitly, am I not free to do what I want with my property? Or are you envious because I am jealous? And then, of course, the parable of the talents. And the interesting thing about the parable of the talents is that the one at the end who's hidden the talent, mind you, he didn't dissipate it. He didn't lose it. He just returned what was given to him. Why is he condemned? He's condemned because his perception of the master is so distorted. In fact, when I read that, I hear the complaint of socialists against business people. You gather where you have not sown and scatter where you have not planted, you know, this kind of thing. It's envious. He doesn't understand the master. He thinks that this master has been so generous, is a tyrant. You are a hard man. And he misconceives the master. Now, again, I'm not saying that that servant read Marx and Engels, but maybe Marx and Engels read him.
I've always thought, I wish I could put one more servant into that parable.
Would that be?
One that comes and says, master, you know, I took the talents that you left me. You left me, say, three talents. And
I lost them.
I lost them. I invested them to the best of my ability.
I took all these risks.
I hedged. But I lost.
I said that in the book. That would have been a very interesting thing. I didn't do much on that, but I just noted that. By the way, the book also, at the end of the book, there's a third of the book. It's not a long book, but the last third of the book is a kind of run through of the New Testament in different economic questions that arise in contexts, like the rich young ruler. That's the occasion where Jesus says that it's harder for a rich man to enter the kingdom of God than it is for camel to go through the eye of the needle. So that's, you know, I kind of deal with that. And, in that, one of the things I discovered as I was writing it is, people always think that this rich young ruler, that, that what Jesus says to him is, go and give away everything you have. And that's not at all what Jesus says to him, at least not initially. Jesus says to him initially, go and sell what you have. Jesus sends him into the market. And somehow his sale of what he has and then his giving, it doesn't even say to give it all. We don't know. All of the translations just says, and give to the poor, that there's a relationship, but what he would sell and how much he would have from that sale and what he would give to the poor. And then come and be my disciple. So it's interesting that Jesus tells him to go into the market, and one presumes that he wants to get a good price on his possessions.
Well, that's interesting. I'm kind of thinking how that connects with the previous parable. Maybe in a sense, this guy was unwilling to go out to sell, to engage in the market, to put these things up and to try to multiply that out and care for the poor.
That's an interesting speculation.
Right. You know, we see that with those good servants, right? So I think we ought to read it in light of that. And B, we see, you know, like the child who comes up to Christ with the scraps of bread and fish that they get expanded. So there's a repeated idea that we give up, but we offer in union with God in order to multiply.
Exactly.
That's how people get fed.
Yes. Yes, exactly. There's a lot of hidden stuff there that people just hadn't thought about. That's my COVID book, by the way. I wrote that during COVID.
I know we gotta start wrapping things up, but I've often been thinking about the Book of Job, rereading that with kind of an economic lens on it. And what amazes me is I tried to calculate his net worth at one point. It's very back of the envelope, but he would have been, it says he's the greatest man in the East, greatest with respect to wealth, though also seems to be the most righteous. So he's unbelievably wealthy, and the amount of camels he has suggests a long-distance trading business. And we see that later reflected with other righteous rich figures like Solomon. It makes a big point about the amount of tribute that he's getting from his international trading. but it says that there's no sin in him. This guy's 100% righteous, and he's also 100% rich. He's running a massive trading business. And one of the people who come to accuse him later says, hey, you know, you were really rich, man. And weren't there some people who came and asked of you and you sent them away? That's why God is punishing you. And he says, no. There was I'm innocent of that. And I think it's interesting that, you know, we're certainly called to be generous, but Job understood that he could retain his wealth and have rotating feasts amongst his family, which it describes in the first chapter. And he could even at times say no to requests to private charity while remaining sinless. I'm confident he was generous, but he knew what to retain and what not to retain. I think that's an incredible lesson in prudence.
You know, I don't want to elongate this, but the assumption that Jesus was always and only among the poor is just false. I mean, where did he get that Seville row suit that he wore to his crucifixion? I mean, that would have been the equivalent of a, you know, a very expensive garment. And who was supporting his ministry? It says these women were supporting him in his ministry. And Mary Magdalene was considered wealthy. If you do the studies on Mary Magdalene, she probably was a dealer in purple, which was a dye that was very expensive. Or Joseph of Arimathea, a new tomb that this man is placed in. Granted, he didn't use it for very long, but nonetheless, there you have it. Around Jesus and around Paul, Lydia, you know, in her own conversion, she opens up her house and all of her servants, she had a good bit of money. So there's not this aversion to wealth as such. It's that these wealthy people their lives ordered properly. They're using things properly.
So what are some final words, kind of in summary, things that you would like to have people know about the importance of markets and the way that it actually helps us achieve the goals of Catholic social teaching?
Well, I think there's so much that could be said on this. I would go back to this notion of the incarnation, to the way in which God redeems the world through the world, in the midst of the world, and to understand that our vocation in the world is not just to tolerate it and get out of it, but to sanctify it. And we do that by the right use of our resources, the use of our minds. We bring the whole of who we are, which includes our moral vocation, to our enterprise. There's the whole utilitarian function of how markets, you know, help the poor. You know, you got to have more than a love for the poor. You have to have a head for the poor. You have to think about how to help people. You can wish the poor to have bread, but if you don't know how to run a bakery, the poor aren't going to get anything. I would close perhaps with an insight from Etienne Gilson, who was a great Thomistic philosopher, French philosopher. And he once made this allusion. He said, if you want to build a cathedral that has a facade like Notre Dame that represents the rising of the soul to God, you must first understand geometry. And then he went on to say, piety never a substitute for technique. For without piety, without technique, piety is helpless to make use of nature for the glory of God.
Wonderful. Well, where can they find some more stuff that you've been working on? Tell us a little bit about the Acton Institute and a couple resources, particularly Catholics might find of use to learn a little bit more about the importance of the markets.
Well, I refer you to acton.org. I mean, it's a veritable library of materials, a lot of Catholic stuff, but also we deal with a lot of Protestant tradition, and we're increasingly looking at Islam and Judaism. So acton.org, there are great resources that are both popular films and highly academic. We produce a journal called the Journal of Markets and Morality, which is the only interdisciplinary journal related to economics and theology that I'm aware of. And that's put out on a regular basis. I have a whole set of colleagues who are working on a wide range of issues. And I think if you just use the search engine on acton.org, you'll find a topic that you're interested in or you're researching. We also have some great conferences that are held in the United States, but also throughout the world. So it was founded to help people think through how their good intentions can connect with just the practical realities of life.
I can't say enough good things about Acton. I've looked through a number of their podcasts and their articles. Absolutely fantastic. There's few institutions which I can just give like 100% everything they say seems dead on.
Well, we're
absolutely one of them. So thank you so much for your work and
you honor us. That. Thank you.
Being a priest and even coming on this year podcast. So thanks so much, Father.
Delighted to do it. God bless you and God bless all your listeners.